Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you very much, Marina, for a fascinating talk on zooming in depth on the ICTY as a particular institution. I think the talk that I'm about to give very much ties nicely into the final point that you made about framing achievements and challenges. So without further ado, I'll dive right into the last presentation of the day, which... Once again, thank you to Professor Morten Bergsma for the kind invitation, and I'm delighted to speak here today on the topic of the power of legacy construction in international criminal justice. What will be your legacy? This is a question that we may know from a very different context, more from a personal arena or a professional arena. Increasingly, the courts themselves have found themselves faced with this question: what will be your legacy? The paper that I'm about to give is based on a wider research project and research that I completed at the London School of Economics over the past few years, in part based on empirical research, having conducted over 230 interviews at various tribunals. It's a wider study, a comparative study of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, for Rwanda, the Special Court for Sierra Leone, and the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia. What I'd like to do here today is just sketch a few of the observations and arguments and focus more on the conceptual than the empirical part, but I'm more than happy and eager to enter into discussions about these topics. Today I'd like to focus on the institutional creation of legacies, and this of course ties into the question of power in international criminal justice and the question of perpetuation of power. The topic of legacy has come into sharper relief as of date, and it's important because it resonates with the politics of meaning and the politics of memory. Increasingly, the topic of legacy has been placed at the doorstep of the tribunals, and there's been an increasing sensitivity in terms of introspection and retrospection that has occurred by various actors within these institutions, as well as outside these institutions. There's very interesting internal and external dynamics that have been going on, and as you're all aware, there are high and conflicting expectations regarding what legacies are and should be. So the questions I'd like to focus on is, how has the anticipated closure, completion of mandate, actually been managed at the tribunals? How did legacy become part of that equation, part of that conversation? And what is the role of the tribunals in legacy formation themselves? So my talk is divided into four sections. First of all, I'd like to set the scene with taking you from completion to continuation. How did legacy appear to become such a center topic? Then looking at the notion of legacy and some observations on the actual notion itself. Then looking at legacy construction as a social process and looking at the social lives and also the importance of organizational memory. And then finally looking at institutionalization of legacy at the tribunals and sketching some dynamics in that regard. More layers and more depth is, of course, contained in the paper. So without further ado, I'll come to the first section, which is from completion to continuation. What I will not do here is rehearse the creation story or the entire institutional developments of the tribunals, which I think are well known to a room such as distinguished participants, architects, and scholars of the international tribunals. But what bears emphasizing is their temporary nature, that their temporary nature was built in from the very start. So they were ad hoc institutions, temporary institutions, which faced then the situation of designing completion strategies, of facing mandate completion, and so the question of institutional succession that has already been mentioned became a very pertinent one. Residual mechanisms have been created. But part of that is also what remains apart from an institutional successor organization, and this is where the question of legacy comes center stage. The point of departure that I'm taking is not the demise or the closure of any particular organization or international criminal tribunal, but rather the question, how do organizations, in this case tribunals, that may disappear institutionally in terms of a formal legal entity, actually continue to live on in some form beyond closure. So in contrast to institutional emergence, evolution, and effects, the topic of organizational decline and organizational closure has been given short shrift to date. Yet eclipsing the end and this very important dynamics that take place with mandate completion and with closure are of fundamental importance to better understand and to have a full appreciation of all the legal, political, social, and economic processes that go hand in hand with this. There's increasingly delicacy of the treatment of time that we see in scholarship, and also the how the field has been shifting and transforming. And I'd like to recognize Mikkel, who's in the room, looking at the closure of the tribunals as a very important moment from a sociological perspective. So there is some work that is, of course, exploring the end from various perspectives. The tribunals, it seems, par excellence, seem to illustrate the interplay of law and politics and of beginnings and endings. And the interplay between continuity and discontinuity is, of course, a very important one, as it seems that finite organizational existence does not equate with finite organizational presence. And here again, the importance of legacies cannot be underestimated. Indeed, the central argument is that these organizations, these tribunals, live on through their legacies. And so legacy building, it seems, has become a central coping strategy vis-a-vis organizational demise by the tribunals. The enduring legal, political, social, and cultural ramifications have, of course, become object of scholarly debate in the last few years, as well as the focus and the object of discussion at the institutions themselves, if we bear in mind the various conferences that have taken place at the tribunals. So there is a recognition that tribunals should leave something lasting behind, beyond prosecuting a select number of individuals. And the 2004 Secretary General's report on the rule of law remarkably foreshadowed, and I quote, "And it is essential that from the moment any future international or hybrid tribunal is created, consideration be given as a priority to the ultimate exit strategy and intended legacy in the country concerned." So this is a reminder that legacies do not emerge simply after closure or at the moment of mandate completion, but are built and being shaped all along, ever since the first day of the work of a tribunal. It seems, borrowing from organizational literature, that organizational demise, or even organizational death, if you like, may be seen as conjuring up risks of oblivion, of loss of meaning, loss of identities, and thus actors may attempt, in this case, to mitigate such risks by engaging precisely in strategies of institutional persistence, and in this case, in legacy building, to face and in a way, transcend the impending mortality. And so in other words, one might suggest that these tribunals have a significant Nachleben or posthumous life. Nachleben, of course, is a concept, a German term, originally developed in art history or by art historian A.B. Warburg, and widely used in art history and reception studies and classics to speak precisely about survival, but also afterlife. And this is an interesting dynamic that I think deserves full attention at the international tribunals. Indeed, while the tribunals may disappear institutionally in the juridical register, one might argue that they seem to continue and perpetuate themselves in the social register. So in a way, this transcending through persistent strategies such as legacy takes place. This ensures, of course, that in the broader Weberian sense of who or what gets to write history and the question of historical significance and historical effectiveness actually takes on a particular salience. I'd like to now turn to the notion of legacy itself. Now, the dictionary definition of legacy is anything that is handed down by an ancestor or predecessor, according to the Oxford English Dictionary. Lexical definitions do not seem to, though, adequately convey the importance of the process behind legacies, and the enormous efforts invested in the creation, in the promotion, and in the maintenance of legacies. Legacies have been conceptualized as bequests, as remains, as lessons, and there would be so much more to say in terms of a wider conceptualization of legacies in and of themselves. But briefly focusing on the language of legacies, it seems indeed that the general appeal of this language of legacy, as well as the very casual usage that we have seen, warrants further examination and calls for caution. Indeed, using legacy solely in the singular seems to appear problematic and misleading, as it doesn't seem to capture the full spectrum of possible legacies, as well as the multiplicity of actors and multiplicity of meanings that the debates and discussions and meanings actually exist. So put simply, legacy means different things to different peoples inside and outside of these very same institutions. And it is precisely, though, the self-evident simplicity of the term legacy that seems to manufacture the term's attractiveness. Oftentimes, in official legacy talk, at the tribunals and also outside, legacies are presented as products of intent or deliberate planning. And so that the assumption is that legacies are highly malleable by the actors themselves. And yet again, this seems to be important to critically question. Another limitation seems to be what McAloon has called the desirability of the discursive object itself, which seems to be charged with specific meanings and a particular desirability. And yet again, a critical investigation needs to take place. There is no uniform or single definition of legacy that exists across all tribunals. The ICTY, in its first legacy conference, defined legacy as that which the tribunal will hand down to successors and others in 2010. And we just heard, of course, that the most recent ICTY legacy conference in 2017 took place in June in Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. The Special Court for Sierra Leone uses a different concept of legacy, which actually is borrowed from a policy tool that the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights issued in 2008, which is a much more specific or narrow definition of legacy, which I'd like to quote here. Legacy in this sense is a lasting impact on bolstering the rule of law by conducting effective trials to contribute to ending impunity while also strengthening domestic judicial capacity. And this definition taken from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights policy tool is actually entitled Maximizing the Legacy. So it seems not merely about leaving a legacy, but maximizing a legacy. And of course, there's a lot of policy thinking that has gone on in this regard. So it seems that a lot of the legacy talk and a lot of the legacy previews that we encounter are formulated in the form of desiderata. These, of course, deserve attention, not possibly for their empirical accuracy as of stocktaking, but of course for the underlying assumptions and the normative components that are carried forth with it. Rosemary Byrne, early piece in 2006 on legacy previews, precisely said, in theory, the verdict on legacy should still be out, at least until all the tribunal's verdicts are in. But in practice, conclusions proliferate on the impact of the ad hoc international criminal tribunals from the conventional to the extreme. And this was recently also picked up in a piece by Sarah Nguyen and Sarah Kendall, calling for precisely an ethos of institutional modesty, given the epistemological frailties and the methodological challenges at this point in time to systematically and adequately assess legacies. So in the absence, it is seen, of demonstrable findings, many of the claims about how the impact are either hypotheses setting forth how tribunals could have an impact, or assertions of hopes or normative opinions as to what the impact should be. And this, of course, leads to the third part, which is constructions of legacy or legacy constructions. So looking at legacies in the plural indeed seems to suggest that there is a very important social constructive process that goes on. And of course, this also is a reminder and an important point to make that legacies seem to have become sites of contestation over remembrance, as a deliberate selective use of the past seems to occur according to demands of the present. In my work, challenging the common depictions of legacy as an objectively measurable end result or a brute fact, I precisely point to a conceptualization of legacy that allows to see legacies as more social facts based on intersubjective meanings. And impoverished depictions of legacy based on a classic sender-receiver model, in this case, legacy leaver, legacy recipient, that doesn't take into account the multiplicity of actors that are actually important and incredibly enriching in terms of the actor landscape of the legacy formation, is important to bear in mind. So rephrasing Alexander Wempf's famous dictum, it is argued that legacy is what tribunals make of it, but also what all other actors make of it too. So it seems that no actor can actually control or create an authoritative version of legacy, but precisely the multiplicity of voices, the multiplicity of actors is part and parcel of the entire process. It seems that within the topic of legacy and why it's also so significant and yet so sensitive at times is that precisely this sensibility for introspection and retrospection, and that legacy building has precisely occurred as a social process, also unearths a number of different identities, a number of different interests within the process. Legacy talk arises in a valedictory setting when reflecting upon the accomplishments, when reflecting upon the meaning of being. Legacy construction, I argue, is ongoing and has been ongoing. This effectively then undermines the idea that the past exists independently and impenetrable from the present and the future. So it seems that institutions, events, retroactively become or who or what they are said to represent. So the legacy process itself, if you like, crystallizes the confluence of the three temporalities, which is the past, the present, and the future, and in many respects actually includes a disruption of a mere strict linear temporality. Legacy building then is sketched as a coping strategy of the tribunals themselves vis-a-vis mandate completion, vis-a-vis the closure. It seems that legacy planning seems to have aided to gain a sense of control and if you like, to master this struggle over the interpretation and this power struggle that is actually going on. In a landmark article by Barnett and Finnemore in 1999 entitled The Politics, Power, and Pathologies of International Organizations, they precisely argue for a new constructivist approach rooted in social institutionalism that explains both power and the propensity for certain dysfunctional dynamics within organizations. And they sketch three broad types of power, namely classification, fixing of meanings, and diffusion of norms. And of course, there would be more to say how this then maps on to the tribunals themselves. But allow me to briefly say something about the significance of socialization within these institutions. And once again, it bears important that the treatment of tribunals in this vein, as Dembour and Kelly have noted, it is crucial to view the institutions of international law, not merely as abstract entities, but as complex social processes. And of course, various processes of socialization are shaping these institutions. And so the term social lives of international justice, or social worlds of tribunals, as Nigel Elchingham has put it, make plain the importance of the social within the context of international tribunals. Now, it is also clear that tensions or clashes occur within these institutions themselves, and so the importance and creative, productive power of what has been called the sense of dissonance, as Stark put it, in organizations has already been convincingly elucidated. And as suggested by many previously, it is important to unpack the black boxes of these organizations, to take into consideration what are the particular identities, what are the particular interests of the actors within, so to question the conventional portrayal of disembodied institutions and disaggregate what is captured by the tribunal, for instance. In this respect, of course, remembering and memorializing within these institutions and outside comes into sharper relief. This process of organizational memory is, of course, not linear, not finite, not mechanic or smooth in any way. But organizational memory formation is, as Bell aptly put it, an ongoing process of negotiation and contestation, battles over the social legacy of the past, and how to interpret it may thus be fought between different mnemonic communities, even within the same organization. And of course, in this regard, places and objects play an important role in experiencing the past through what Pierre Nora called lieu de mémoire. And of course, we have both tangible legacies as well as very intangible legacies that are very important and that play a considerable role in this regard. So in other words, the interest in legacy formation is both or is traced on multiple levels, both at the psychological level, if you like, this idea of nearness to death or nearness to mandate completion, so very much individual self-examination of life's purpose, which can take place at an individual or at an institutional level. In ideational terms, then, the installation of particular norms of rule of law, of justice. And in this regard, I'd like to sketch very briefly what Bingham wrote, namely that, I quote, "It is the symbolic function of the tribunal, so apparent in the rhetoric of their creation, that is most threatened by the prospect of permanent closure." In other words, not only will the tribunal no longer be out there, they will also face the difficulty of closing without unraveling or distorting their role as a symbolic validation of the international community's commitment to bring war criminals to justice. And I think we've heard a lot about the symbolic power of these institutions, so I won't delve into more depth in that regard. But of course, there are also, in material terms, particular drivers of this process of legacy formation, which again, I'm more than happy to discuss in more detail later on. So countering the dearth of preoccupation with the actual process of legacy, in my work I have sketched the contours of the legacy formation as a social process to better understand both the agency as well as the structures that form part and parcel of this entire dynamic. And oftentimes the actors are not seen to be given center stage, and yet this oversight is problematic as it, on the one hand, obfuscates that it is precisely a social process that is taking place, and at the same time it ignores the actor diversity of all those involved in these institutions. Now clearly not all actors are given equal weight, are given equal recognition or standing or voice, and they all come from very different vantage points. But it's important that while the dyad of the legacy leaver and the legacy recipient or recipients frames this process of legacy leaving and legacy building, it is a very important dynamic and yet, of course, not the sole dynamic. So again, looking at all the other actors that I have framed as producers, enforcers, and recorders of legacy are also very important to take into account. More widely, the cycle of legacies is also very important to bear in mind. And there again, in my wider work, I've looked at the cycle of legacies and looked at various moments and dynamics of creation, consolidation, and contestation of legacy, which I don't have time here to go into more depth. But in short, legacies are constructed, if you like, ad infinitum. So no legacy actor actually controls the definitive meanings of these institutions. And time, if you like, performs the role of a prism, refracting unpredictable meanings and purposes. And this leads to the last point, which is, of course, that of the role of the legacy leavers themselves and how the institutions themselves have taken up this question of legacy. And here I'd just like to sketch a three-step kind of trend that I've observed, which I've called institutionalization of legacy building, because it seems, again, a common solution has been to focus on legacy building with the tribunals. The idea has taken hold in the tribunals rhetorically, structurally, and practically, and there are three levels to this, or dynamics, that while they didn't occur consecutively, I will name in order. One is projection, so developing a legacy vision which has happened through internal work documents or through public documents at the various tribunals to varying degrees. The second is professionalization, in other words, creating particular legacy committees or legacy positions within these institutions shows that the term itself has become part and parcel of the structures within this institution. And then third and lastly, what might be called projectification, borrowing from project management, which means designing and implementing legacy projects, which have been delineated. And this, of course, shows that legacy formation is not just an amorphous undertaking, but considerable amounts of money, time, and effort have actually been spent within these institutions to create particular legacy projects and more widely to create legacies. So as we can see, there's been a continuum of legacy strategies that have unfolded within these institutions. And there are, of course, particular dynamics within these. I'd like to emphasize here that there's an enormous variation between the different tribunals. And there are individual intra-institutional and inter-institutional dynamics which need to be scrutinized and which need to be given due attention in order to sketch this landscape of where we see consensus or where we see dissonance within these institutions. So to conclude, we have seen what might be called a legacy turn within these tribunals that has resulted in heightened, though not always effective, reflexivity. And this has crystallized how tribunals respond to the specter of organizational decline. So although framed as dealing with the past, these are, of course, processes very much about the present, very much about the future. So legacy building, in that sense, can be seen as an institutional persistence strategy, and the tribunals live on through the legacies that they create, and here the importance of the plural is one to emphasize. So challenging the common depiction of legacies as merely objective, measurable end results precisely needs to be complemented by a view that looks at how these legacies are actively produced and how they're actively received and reconstructed over time. So legacy formation is ongoing. The social construction is one that's important to note, the multifaceted nature of this. And so embedding this within a process-oriented framework, recognizing how the term legacy itself is mobilized, how meaning is allocated, which power is wielded, projected, and perpetuated, and which actors are actually involved, allows to show the representational, the symbolic, and the visual power that forms part of this. So finally, to end, debates about legacies are not solely about the legacies themselves, but are also a reflection and a sideshow, of course, about wider debates about criminal tribunals, the raison d'être, the international model, the hybrid model, international involvement, and meanings of justice locally, regionally, and globally. So focus on legacy provides insight to the larger question of how organizations portray and perpetuate themselves, and hence the question of legacy construction. It's important to appreciate it is not only a legal, but also a political question and a social question, and indeed a question of power. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.